Hello, this is the Abstract Podcast, the podcast that takes the new scientific literature of veterinary clinical pathology to you. No fluff, no stress, just an easy way to catch up with what is new while you drive, exercise, or have breakfast.
We search PubMed every week and select the studies relevant to veterinary clinical pathology that were added this week. You then decide if you prefer to go and read the whole manuscript later. I am Sarah.
And I am Alex. We are AI-generated hosts, but the science discussed is grounded in PubMed. So this is the week from August 30th, 2026 to September 5th, 2026. Right, let's start in our home journal, Veterinary Clinical Pathology. We have a few of their classic "What is your diagnosis?" case reports. First up is one from Allier and colleagues at Mississippi State University in the USA.
This one is titled "Organisms in Cerebrospinal Fluid of a Dog." As it's a case report, there's no abstract, but these are always great educational refreshers.
Exactly. These cases are fantastic for honing your cytology skills. They present the images and history, you make your call, and then turn the page to see the interpretation. For this one, it's all about identifying unusual organisms where they shouldn't be, in the CSF. It's a great test of your microscopic abilities.
A valuable exercise, certainly. But remember, it is a single case. Its purpose is educational, not to establish prevalence or clinical patterns.
Sticking with CSF, Dauden and colleagues from Chester Gates Veterinary Specialists in the UK have a case report on an 8-year-old Whippet crossbreed.
The paper is "Eosinophilic Cerebrospinal Fluid Pleocytosis in a Dog with Hypertrophic Pachymeningitis and Generalized Eosinophilic Disease." It's a case report, so N equals 1. The dog had collapsing episodes, and MRI showed a thickened dura mater. The key finding was a marked eosinophilic pleocytosis in the CSF.
Interesting. Eosinophils in the CSF usually make you think of infectious or neoplastic causes, but they ruled those out. The dog was euthanized, and post-mortem revealed a diffuse eosinophilic pachymeningitis.
Well, the authors state this is the first report of eosinophilic pleocytosis with this condition in a dog. It's an interesting observation, but from a single case, you can't draw any broad conclusions. It's an association, not a proven link.
I hear you, but for a clinician faced with eosinophils in a CSF tap, this adds a rare differential to the list. It's another piece of the puzzle, even if it's a corner piece.
We have another "What is your diagnosis?" This one from Zuber and colleagues at Auburn University in the USA.
The title is simply "Subcutaneous Mass on the Chest of a Dog." Again, this is a classic cytology challenge. You're presented with the aspirate from a subcutaneous lump, one of the most common samples we see in practice.
This format is about pattern recognition. Is it inflammatory? Is it neoplastic? If neoplastic, is it mesenchymal, epithelial, or a round cell tumor?
It's a perfect, low-stakes way to practice your 5-point plan for slide assessment. It forces you to be systematic, and these published cases often have a subtle twist or a classic presentation of a less common tumor. It's a good way to keep your eyes sharp.
Next, a case series from Yamazaki and colleagues at Rakuno Gakuen University in Japan, also in veterinary clinical pathology.
This one is 2 cases of feline hepatosplenic cytotoxic T-cell lymphoma with hemophagocytosis. They described 2 cats with pancytopenia and massive splenomegaly. Splenic cytology was key, showing large atypical lymphocytes that were actually phagocytosing red and white blood cells.
A case series with an N of 2 is very small. They confirmed CD3 and granzyme B positive cytotoxic T cell lymphoma. One cat was treated with chemo and died at 88 days. The other had a splenectomy followed by chemo and survived to 278 days.
But they suggest the splenectomy might have helped by reducing the hemophagocytic activity, which makes sense if the spleen is the primary site. For such a rare and aggressive disease, even a report on 2 cases can offer a potential therapeutic direction.
A direction, perhaps. But let's be clear. This doesn't prove splenectomy is the superior approach. The spin here is a bit heavy. We need much more data before changing protocols based on 1 anecdotal success.
Let's move on to veterinary pathology. This is a big one for the future of our field. It's from Cao and colleagues at Texas A&M University in the USA.
This is a validation study titled Artificial Intelligence-Based Detection of Small and Intermediate to Large Lymphocytes for Cytologic Diagnosis of Canine Lymphoma. They used an AI algorithm, YOLOV-11, to identify lymphocytes on images taken with smartphones. The population was 45 dogs, 34 with lymphoma, and 11 without.
And the results were impressive. After training, the model achieved near-perfect performance at the aspirate level, correctly diagnosing all test cases by assessing the proportion of large lymphocytes. This could be a huge step towards point-of-care cytology assistance.
Let's temper the excitement. The model performed best when they simplified the problem to a three-label approach: small lymphocytes, large lymphocytes, and neutrophils. It also needs extensive external validation on a wider range of lymph node diseases before it's ready for clinical use. But the methodology is sound for a foundational study.
I agree, it's not ready to replace a pathologist tomorrow. But imagine a general practitioner being able to get an immediate AI-assisted second opinion on a lymph node aspirate. That's a powerful tool.
All right, next paper is from Baldin and colleagues at the University of Bologna, Italy, published in the Journal of Veterinary Diagnostic Investigation.
This is an analytical validation study of the Mindre BC75R VET hematology analyzer, comparing it to the Siemens Advia 212OI. This is the kind of practical research labs are always looking for.
Indeed. This was a robust methods comparison. They used 411 dog and 225 cat samples, which is a very good sample size. They assessed precision, linearity, and carryover. The new analyzer showed high precision and good linearity for most parameters.
So, is it a good machine? What's the bottom line for a lab manager?
The agreement with the Advia was good to excellent for most CBC parameters in both species. However, platelet counts in cats showed a constant and proportional bias. The total observed error was acceptable for most things, but not for feline platelet counts.
Ah, the eternal problem of feline platelets. So it seems like a solid machine for dogs, but you'd still need to be cautious and likely perform manual reviews for cat platelet counts. That's a critical piece of information for anyone considering a purchase.
Now to veterinary ophthalmology, for a case report from D'Souza Viana and colleagues at the Federal Rural University of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil.
The title is Transconjunctival Orbitotomy as Surgical Management of an Orbital Lipoma in a Dog. This was a 14-year-old border collie with chronic exophthalmos, a bulging eye, due to a retrobulbar mass.
It's a single case report. A CT scan suggested adipose tissue, and cytology supported the suspicion. The diagnosis of orbital lipoma was confirmed on histopathology after removal.
The key point here is the surgical technique. They used an anterior subconjunctival orbitotomy, which is a more minimally invasive approach. They managed to remove the mass while preserving the dog's eye and its vision. It's a nice surgical demonstration.
Yes, it highlights a good outcome for a benign lesion using a function-preserving technique, clinically useful for ophthalmologists and surgeons facing a similar case.
Staying in veterinary ophthalmology, we have a review article from D'Agostino and colleagues at the University of Missouri, USA.
This is titled Canine Tear Proteomics, A New Frontier in Veterinary Ophthalmology. As a review, it summarizes the current literature rather than presenting new data. It discusses using tears, a non-invasive biofluid, to find protein biomarkers for disease.
This is fascinating stuff. They highlight studies that have found potential tear biomarkers for conditions like KCS, glaucoma, and even systemic diseases like diabetes mellitus. Imagine diagnosing or monitoring KCS by analyzing a tear sample instead of just measuring tear quantity.
The potential is there, yes. The review covers the technology and key protein alterations. However, it also correctly points out the fundamental challenges. We're still in the early days. Standardization of collection and analysis is a major hurdle.
So it's not something we'll be doing in practice next week, but it's a great summary of a really promising research area that could one day give us powerful new diagnostic tools for our ophthalmic cases.
Moving to our Tier 2 journals. First, from JAVMA, a review by Robertson and colleagues at Virginia Tech in the USA.
The topic is Liquid biopsy technologies offer new insights and approaches for canine cancer detection and management. Liquid biopsy is the analysis of fluids like blood or urine for cancer biomarkers. It's a hot topic in human oncology, and it's making its way into vet med.
This is a review, so no PICOS. It provides an overview of the technology. The authors are quite measured in their assessment, which is good to see. They state clearly that liquid biopsy is not intended to replace tissue biopsy.
That's a critical point. They also mention that while it might one day provide early-stage cancer detection, this hasn't been proven yet for humans or dogs. It's still primarily an investigational tool.
Exactly. The conclusion is that while several tests are now commercially available to veterinarians, we need to be cautious. The technology is promising, but its clinical utility for routine cases is not yet established. This review is a good, sober look at the current state of play.
Also in JAVMA, a paper from Gentry and colleagues at Texas A&M University, USA, looking at how clinicians manage canine atopic dermatitis.
This was an online survey study of 718 veterinarians in North America. The goal was to understand their diagnostic and prescribing behaviors, especially in the face of client financial constraints.
And the findings are very relatable. 57% of vets said at least a quarter of their clients had substantial financial constraints. And not surprisingly, this often guided their recommendations. For example, they preferred cefalexin for pyoderma when cost was an issue.
A survey's main limitation is always response bias. We don't know if the 718 respondents are representative of all vets. That said, the study highlights a disconnect. Most vets knew about guideline recommendations, like using topical antiseptics for MRSP, but their stated practices didn't always align.
Which just reflects the messy reality of clinical practice. It's a constant balance between gold standard care and the spectrum of care dictated by a client's budget. This paper does a good job of quantifying that daily struggle.
Now to the American Journal of Veterinary Research. A paper by Savo and colleagues from a private specialty hospital in New Jersey, USA.
This is a reference interval determination study for parathyroid hormone, ionized calcium, and total calcium in domestic rabbits. This is incredibly useful data for anyone treating these species.
I agree. The methodology appears sound. They used 50 clinically healthy, client-owned adult rabbits, which is a decent number for a reference interval study in an exotic species. They followed the ASVCP guidelines.
So we finally have some numbers for intact PTH in rabbits. They report a reference interval of 0.50 to 5.90 picomoles per liter. They also provide intervals for ionized and total calcium.
They did note a statistically significant, though likely clinically insignificant, difference between ionized calcium measured in whole blood on a point-of-care device versus serum on a benchtop analyzer.
That's good to know. Having these reference intervals is crucial for diagnosing and managing calcium disorders in rabbits, which can be quite challenging. This is a paper to print out and keep. Let's jump over to the Australian Veterinary Journal for a case report from Sahibjam and colleagues in Tasmania, Australia.
This paper details the successful treatment of the first reported case of Prototheca wickerhami infection in a dog living in Tasmania, Australia. It's a single case report of a 2-year-old Chihuahua cross.
This dog had a localized cutaneous form of protothecosis, affecting its paw pads. Canine protothecosis is usually a disseminated disease with a poor prognosis, so a localized form is unusual.
They tried 3 treatment protocols. Itraconazole was ineffective. Posaconazole controlled the clinical signs, but the dog relapsed when it was stopped. The final successful treatment was intralesional amphotericin B deoxycholate, which achieved sustained remission.
So for a localized lesion, intralesional therapy seems like a great option to avoid systemic toxicity of amphotericin B. This is a useful report for dermatologists and internists, suggesting a viable treatment path for a tricky infection.
Now for something very practical from the Journal of Feline Medicine and Surgery. It's the 2026 ICAT-CARE Consensus Guidelines on the Diagnosis and Management of Chronic Kidney Disease in Cats.
Authored by Taylor and a whole panel of experts. This isn't a research study, but a comprehensive clinical guide. CKD is one of the most common diseases we manage in older cats, so updated guidelines are always welcome.
These guidelines are built on the IRIS staging system. They cover pathogenesis, diagnosis, and staging, but also, and this is crucial, practical advice on medical and nutritional treatment.
I like that they also discuss optimizing the cat's environment and supporting the caregiver. Managing a cat with CKD can be a huge burden on owners, and acknowledging that is a big part of successful long-term care.
Absolutely. It covers complications like hypertension and proteinuria, managing comorbidities, and working as a team. This is a foundational document that every small animal practitioner should read and be familiar with. It really synthesizes the best practices for managing feline CKD.
All right, into our final group of journals. First up, from PLOSONE, a paper by Sacchettino and colleagues at the University of Naples, Federico the Fide in Italy.
This is an observational study titled, Targeted Lipidomics Showed Altered Serum Phosphatidylcholine Levels in Fearful Dogs. They compared the serum lipid profiles of fearful dogs to a control group.
And they found a distinct pattern. The fearful dogs had significant alterations in several lipid species, especially phosphatidylcholines. This suggests that lipid metabolism might be involved in the pathophysiology of fear and anxiety in dogs.
Well, the abstract doesn't state the sample size or how fearfulness was objectively defined and scored, which are critical details. Without that information, it's hard to assess the strength of the evidence. Dysregulation of membrane phospholipids is plausible, but this is very preliminary.
I see your point on the methods, but it's an interesting concept that a behavioral disorder could have a measurable metabolic signature. It paves the way for future research that might lead to objective biomarkers for anxiety, which would be a game changer for veterinary behavior.
We have two related articles from the Veterinary Clinics of North America. Both are reviews on artificial intelligence. The first is by Basran and colleagues at Cornell University, USA.
This one is Artificial Intelligence-Assisted Interpretation of Veterinary Radiographs. It's less about the tech itself and more about how clinicians should use it responsibly.
A very necessary conversation. The key message is that AI is a decision support tool, not a replacement for a clinician. The veterinarian remains 100% accountable for the diagnosis and treatment plan.
They also stress the need for transparency. You shouldn't use an AI system if you can't explain its basic function and limitations to a client. It's all about informed and responsible implementation, team training, maintaining traditional skills, and quality control.
This is essentially a best practices guide for adopting A-EI in imaging. It's a must read for any practice owner thinking about investing in this technology.
And the second review, also from Vet Clinics, is by Chu from Texas A&M University.
This one is Computer Vision and Deep Learning in Small Animal Cytology and Slide Review. It's a perfect companion to the AI lymphoma paper we discussed earlier.
It gives a foundational overview of how these computer vision models work and summarizes the current research in veterinary cytology, including blood smear review.
Importantly, the author discusses the gaps in transparency and standardization from commercial vendors. They also touch upon the professional implications, like the risk of de-skilling and the need for new professional guidelines.
It's another call for informed adoption. We need to be literate in A-I to use these tools effectively and safely. This review provides a great starting point for pathologists and practitioners to understand both the opportunities and the risks.
Next, in Veterinary Medicine and Science, a paper by Ferre Dulce and colleagues from Spain looking at breeding practices in Italy.
The title is Dog Breeding in Italy, a technical overview of husbandry and reproductive management. It's a survey of 251 certified Italian dog breeders.
The results show that practices were generally consistent with veterinary recommendations. For example, over 96% used progesterone measurement for timing mating. Ultrasonography was widely used for pregnancy diagnosis.
But there were some gaps. About 70% of breeders using progesterone testing didn't know which analytical method was being used, which can be important for interpretation.
And that's the key takeaway. It's a snapshot of current practices that identifies areas for targeted breeder education. There's an opportunity for vets to improve client knowledge on topics like progesterone assay interpretation and the use of vaginal cytology to standardize and improve breeding management.
Also in Veterinary Medicine and Science, a pilot study from Siplak and colleagues at Atatürk University in Turkey.
Association between postoperative pain and inflammatory biomarkers after ovariohysterectomy in dogs. This was a prospective clinical study with 20 healthy female dogs undergoing elective spays. They measured pain scores and a panel of biomarkers like TNF-alpha, IL-6, CRP, and cortisol at 5 time points.
And what did they find? Did the biomarkers go up when the pain scores went up?
No, that's the crucial finding. While the pain scores and the biomarkers all increased postoperatively and then returned to baseline, there was no statistically significant correlation between the pain score and any biomarker at any time point.
So a dog with a high CRP wasn't necessarily the one with the highest pain score. That's a really important negative finding.
Exactly. I'm just not buying the utility of these markers for this purpose. The conclusion is that these common systemic inflammatory and stress biomarkers do not reliably reflect acute postoperative pain intensity. We still need to rely on our clinical pain scoring. Now to veterinary parasitology, with a study on feline leishmaniosis by Lionel and colleagues from the University of Sao Paulo, Brazil.
This paper offers new insights into diagnosing leishmania in cats. This is a growing area of concern, and our diagnostic tools are mostly adapted from dogs.
This was a diagnostic accuracy study in 51 cats. They compared serology, IFAT, and DP, and PCR on various sample types against a reference standard of parasitology plus clinical signs. IFAT had 100% sensitivity, but specificity was poor at a 1 to 40 cutoff, improving to 62% at 1 to 80. The DPP test was highly specific.
And for PCR, what's the best sample to take?
The PCR assays showed excellent sensitivity and specificity on invasive samples like lymph node or bone marrow. But among non-invasive samples, conjunctival swabs were the winner, performing nearly as well as the invasive samples. Oral swabs were not as good.
That's fantastic clinical information. A conjunctival swab is so much easier and safer to collect in practice. This study gives us solid evidence to support using it for molecular diagnoses of FNTL. Okay, let's wrap up with a couple of quick reports on some less common species, both from veterinary clinical pathology. First, one from Kegel and colleagues at the University of Florida.
What is your diagnosis? Rostral lesions in a Rio Grande cichlid. Again, no abstract, but a great chance to see some fish pathology. It's a good reminder of the breadth of species we might encounter.
Absolutely. It's a chance to look at some cytology from a cichlid and test your knowledge of fish diseases. Always good to stretch the brain beyond cats and dogs.
And finally, a study by Nahar and colleagues from Chattogram Veterinary and Animal Sciences University in Bangladesh.
This one is Preliminary Reference Interval Estimation for Hemolymph Analysis in Free-Ranging Mangrove Horseshoe Crab.
Yes, they established preliminary reference intervals for amebocyte counts and various biochemical parameters from the hemolymph of 40 wild-caught horseshoe crabs.
Wow, that is niche. But for aquatic and zoo veterinarians, this kind of foundational data is priceless. It's the very first step toward being able to use clinical pathology to assess the health of these ancient and biomedically important animals.
A solid piece of foundational work and a good place for us to end for the week. That wraps up this week's literature. Please remember that an abstract-only appraisal cannot evaluate full methodology. The scope of this podcast is to provide a taster to stimulate your appetite, to read the actual manuscripts of those papers that capture your interest.
Also, please note that we are AI-generated hosts and may occasionally get details wrong. It is ultimately your responsibility to double-check the veracity of the information, particularly if this is going to affect your clinical practice. Thanks for listening.